the J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of the J-Talk Podcast for 2023. I'm Ben Maxwell, joined as always by Sam Robson. And Sam, well, yeah, it's great to be back for another season. We are back in business.
Yeah, I'm delighted to be back. It seems like forever since we were last on. I don't think we've had such a long break in years, given all the COVID stuff and all that. It just seems like the J-League has been nonstop. So I've enjoyed the break, but I'm very much looking forward to getting back into it.
Yeah, it's only been about a month, but yeah, it does feel a bit longer than that for me too, I think. Yeah, but yeah, a well-deserved break for us after, well, Japan's unfortunate exit from the World Cup. And yeah, you were buzzing to get back into it and trying to get me to bring it back last week, Sam. But yeah, I thought better slow your roll and yeah, let's ease back into it on this episode, our first, as I said, of the new calendar year. And in just a moment, we'll be joined by Dan Olowitz from the Japan Times to chat about some of the major changes coming to the J-League. Well, some of them starting in 2023, but yeah, the majority in 2024. And there are some big changes on the horizon for the J-League. But first, if you're a new listener to J-Talk, firstly, welcome aboard and thanks for giving us a go. We hope you'll be entertained enough to want to come back for more. We're about to start previewing the new J1 season that gets going in the middle of February. And our next four episodes will be dedicated to previewing all 18 J1 clubs before the season kicks off on the 17th of February, with the last season's top two going at it on Friday Night Football. Should be an absolute sensational game to kick off the new season. So yeah, if you're a new listener, my name's Ben. I'm the host of J-Talk and have been since 2012. Yeah, trying to remember back. That's right, isn't it? Apart from a break in 2017 when my second child was born, we've been ever present and bring you up to date on, predominantly J1, but the Japan national team as well. And it's been quite a wild ride so far, and one that, have thoroughly enjoyed. Sam, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm Sam. This is going to be my fourth season co-hosting this, which seems to have gone by really quickly. But yeah, I've covered Japanese football for 8.5 years for London-based statistics company Football Radar. I absolutely love it. I'm delighted to have found this podcast in the first place and honoured to be a part of it. So looking forward to, another season getting into the greatest league in the world.
Yes, indeed. Hear to that. So, if you subscribe to the J-Talk podcast, you will get to not only this, our main podcast, but you'll also get episodes of our sister show, J-Talk Extra Time, that covers the second and third tier of the Japanese game with John Steele, James Taylor, and occasionally Stuart Smith in the control room for J2, and Mike Innes, who handles J3 superbly. And that podcast is also well worth a listen, I can promise you. So, as I said, if you're a new listener, welcome aboard. And we hope you'll stick around for what is sure to be a yet another fantastic season in the J-League. All right. So, that's a bit of our intro to kick us off in this new campaign. After a quick hit of music, Dan Olowitz will join us to bring us up to date with some of these huge changes coming to the J-League. Our first guest of 2023 is a very familiar voice around these parts and our go-to guy on the bigger picture J-League issues, Dan Olowitz. Happy new season and welcome back to the pod. How are you?
I've had better days. I think my followers will know I got tagged by COVID near the end of last year. So if I don't sound as vibrant as I usually do, it's because it's still hitting my throat. But going to try to power through this. So happy new year to you and Sam and everyone listening.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I asked how you are, but I kind of know you're not great. But we really appreciate you jumping on board with us, Dan, as I said, for our first episode of 2023. So, we've got you on because obviously over the winter break, the J-League made several significant announcements about how the league will look in the years to come. Some of these changes are coming into effect this year, including potential relegation from J3 to the non-league JFL. But almost all of the major changes kick in 2024, including all three divisions having 20 teams apiece, and the Levain Cup going straight knockout and involving teams from all three divisions for the first time in its history. Our patrons have heard John Steele quiz various guests, including myself, on some of these changes in his extra time off-season slash New Year specials. But as the man who brought these changes to most of our attention through your epic Twitter thread on December 20, Dan, I guess 20 is the number of the hour. How do you feel about J1 shifting to 20 clubs on a permanent basis? And do you have any concerns about the quality of the top division with that many clubs in it?
I think that we look back to the 2021 season, and that was a 20-team J1 because of the circumstances of the pandemic, and we all thought, oh, this will be fun and different, but it is certainly sort of the way it is going forward permanently now, and you have to really think about, well, most of the big European leagues are at 20 clubs in their first division, and that's clearly what the J League is thinking here. They think that 20 is the nice round number that they want to go for. I think that, you know, as far as the J1 goes, it doesn't really matter if there's 18 clubs or if there's 20 clubs. There's always going to be a couple clubs that just can't hack it, and they're going to get relegated, and that's just sort of the way it is. I think that this will be better for the J2 and make that more of an interesting competition, because I think that 22 clubs was too many. And the J3, I mean, it's incredible progress that the third division has made in what will have been a decade, to go from however many clubs they started with in 2014, which included the under 21 selection, the Olympic squad for Brazil, and the fact that that's now going to be at 20 clubs, many of whom will have had J2 experience, it's massive. It is, overall, it's a positive sign of the stability of the Japanese pyramid and how far it's come. So in that sense, I think it's a positive development.
You've had a little bit of time to digest the news as well, Sam. So how do you feel about it? As Dan said, we did have 20 as recently as 2 years ago. That was for the first time ever. Do you, looking back on that year, did you notice any sort of a dip in the overall standard of the league with that extra couple of teams in it? And do you have any worries about the league expanding to that size on a permanent basis?
Well, I think in that season you had two teams, especially Yokohama and Sendai, who were noticeably very poor. They were always at the bottom of the league. I think we'd relegated them maybe after about 10 rounds of the season. So there is that worry that you do get a slight drop-off in overall quality. But hopefully, well, if it comes a permanent thing and the J-League don't keep messing with the format, as seems to have been the case over the last 10 years, everything has changed. We've had two-stage systems, we've had 18, we've had 20, we're back to and whatnot. So as long as they give that a bit of time, then hopefully there's can be a degree of like catching up from those bottom area teams and then the top of J2, and it more evens itself out. But I think, yeah, the first few years I would worry a little bit about the quality towards the bottom, but overall I think it's a positive change across the entire landscape. As Dana said, I think it's a great success from the J-League to be able to get into this position with the 60 teams. I think J2 is the league that will benefit the absolute most, and that's going to be a really exciting league. 20 teams, that cuts down so much. It's such a slog it can be, J2, going through the summer. So I think to cut those games and then to have everywhere from sixth up and then the bottom three involved in something towards the end of the season, I think that makes for a really exciting season. So great for J2. I have slight concerns for J1, and then this season with just the one relegated team, I'm not entirely in favour of that. I'd like to have had a little bit more leeway with relegated teams, but I guess it is what it is.
Indeed. So, yeah, if any listeners aren't aware, there'll just be one of the 18 J1 teams relegated to J2 at the end of the 2023 season, with the three coming up from the second tier, two automatically and the third through the playoffs. So, guys, obviously this a couple of these changes are huge for the extra time boys to cover. I mean, the elimination of the promotion relegation playoff between J1 and J2 teams means that the J2 playoff winner will automatically, go go up to J1. They don't have to play an extra game away at a J1 club. And obviously, Mike Innes will be licking his lips at the prospect of J3 playoffs as well in 2024, not to mention, having to entertain the prospect of relegation to the JFL from J3 this coming season. So, obviously, to the format of the three leagues, there's going to be some significant changes. But, I guess a uniformity of 20 clubs in each division maybe sounds good to some of the bean counters at J League House, and that's what they've settled on. As Dan said, it is an enormous progress to get J3 up to the number of 20 clubs as two more coming in this season. But I mean, the league as a whole in its 30th season to be at 60 clubs now is it's a remarkable achievement, and it shows how far that the league as a whole has come in that time. Dan, I mean, the Levain Cup is something that we've been hankering for reform to for such a long time. And I don't know, why do you think they've finally gone and done it now? Is this 30-year milestone sparked change, do you think, behind the scenes at J League House? Or why have they decided to suddenly up and change the Levain Cup, starting next season?
I think that, again, I brought up earlier that 20 teams is sort of the European standard, except for, I think, one or two of the elite countries. Three up, three down is, again, something England does, something I believe Germany does, Italy, France. And as far as League Cups go, those certainly aren't as common, but group stages, I mean, who does that, really? Mm. So from that perspective, I think that they've done the math, and we're, as you mentioned, none of us are tremendous fans of the Levain Cup in its current format. And I think that any step that the J League can take to make it an interesting tournament outside of the final really is welcome. And this will be really exciting to have J2 teams and J3 teams in not only in the mix, but I should hope that they will be hosting some games. The worst thing about the Emperor's Cup is that these games are taking place at J1 stadiums in the middle of the season, and nobody's coming because nobody wants to see FC Tokyo get upset by Juntendo in front of 3,000 people. I would much rather see Morioka host Kawasaki or Iwabari host Urawa. Like, those are going to be fun games. I think that the magic of the cup is something that Australia have figured out. The United States has figured out with the US Open Cup. And I should hope that the J League has taken notes. And that's what I'm really looking forward to seeing from the Levain Cup in 2024 and beyond.
Do you anticipate any sort of response from the Emperor's Cup if the Levain Cup, say, becomes a more exciting version of the Emperor's Cup? Is there anything that competition can do in your mind to increase the interest in that? Maybe move to weekend games to make that a little bit more interesting rather than having empty stadiums and whatnot in the summer? Because it kind of looks like if the Levain Cup takes over and becomes, as you say, more exciting, like, where does that leave the Emperor's Cup?
Well, I think, and maybe this is the elephant in the room that Ben is going to bring up later, but a lot of that is going to depend on what the calendar looks like, because the league has allegedly started considering this switch to fall spring. And if they're doing that, well, then you have to think, well, what's the J League going to do over the summer? So it could be that the Levain Cup becomes a summer tournament and the Emperor's Cup sort of becomes a fall tournament. I don't have anything to sort of back that up. That's just sort of an idea, a suggestion. But that could be what we see in that the Levain Cup becomes more of a seasonal thing and the Emperor's Cup gets shifted to the second half of the year. I could see that working.
Yeah, okay. I've certainly got concerns about that, as we're going to come on to in a minute. Now, obviously, 60 clubs in a knockout tournament doesn't quite work maths wise, does it? But I think they'll have to have 56 teams play 28 matches in the first round, and maybe four teams will be drawn out to have a bye and join those 28 winners in the round of 32. I'm sure they've obviously got their boffin caps on, working that out at J League House as we speak. But very much looking forward to a knockout at Levain Cup. But again, yeah, there certainly are concerns on the Emperor's Cup and its future. And does Japan really need two knockout cup competitions? Well, I guess we'll find out over the course of the next few seasons. But tell me how this is going to work, Dan. Tell me how August to May, tell me how that season would work in Japan when, you've got three divisions, you've got 60 clubs, and you've got some teams playing in the north of Japan that simply don't have the facilities to clear massive amounts of snow off their pitch, let alone their training facilities during the week to play games on the weekend. I mean, the J-League's considering it. For me, it would be an absolute non-starter. But how is this even workable, do you think?
If you're asking me personally, I still don't know how it's workable, and I'm not sure that the J-League knows how it's workable. I believe the last time the league seriously considered this in 2017, something like 80% of the clubs were against it. Mm. So to give listeners some background, this is all coming about because the Asian Champions League is also changing to a fall spring competition. It's going to start in September this year and finish in May, I believe. And so the Asian Football Confederation is urging members to also shift their calendars to match that. From the league's perspective, they want to make it easier for clubs to sign foreign players, for Japanese players to go to Europe. And if you look at it from that perspective, yes, it is disruptive for star J-League players to leave in the middle of the season because that's the European summer. But as you say, the weather is an issue. What are Yamagata, Hachinohe, and Morioka going to do when it's February and the pitch is frozen solid? Mm. One possible solution is that the JFA will provide funding to northern clubs to help upgrade their facilities and leave them in a better position to play in the winter months between, say, December and February, March. Then you're getting into the question of, well, what are the fans going to do?
Absolutely.
Because those stadiums are not heated. Actually, I shouldn't say that. I've never actually been to any of the main Tohoku stadiums north of your tech. But I'm pretty sure that there isn't a single stadium in Japan that has heated seats or anything like that, except for, say, the dome stadiums. So are the fans going to come out? Are they going to be able to travel to games? You know, if it's winter, if the highways are snowy, I don't know what that situation is. What if the trains can't run? You have to move the players, of course, and the team staff and all that. So shifting the schedule, I should point out that they would be talking about a gradual shift. I think pushing the 2024 through 2026 seasons gradually up a month or two at a time, so that there wouldn't be, you know, a 6 month gap between the end of, say, the 2025 season, the start of the 2026 season. Mm. You know, playing in the summer has always been a pretty big concern in Japan. It's humid, it's hot. There is a risk there for the players. There's a risk there for the fans. But on the other hand, summer is when you're drawing your biggest numbers aside from the end of the season. That's when you're holding your events, your festivals. That's when you're doing your fireworks nights. That's when you're getting the kids who are off on holiday during their summer break from school. So if you're giving that up, like, that, those are your money-making games right there. Like, that's when your promotion teams are pulling out all the stops. So I don't know how this works, and I don't think that the J-League has figured it out either. But I think they're going to at least try to over the next year or so, because their hands are sort of tied. And this is something that the JFA has been pushing the J-League to do for the last 20 or so years, and the J-League has always stood pretty firm against it. So we'll see how it goes.
One theory I've seen bandied around is that certain teams like your Sapporo, your Hachinohe's will essentially become road teams for like 4 months of the season and like be based elsewhere for what, December through March or whatnot. Is there any way that those teams would accept that sort of arrangement? It seems sportingly quite unfair. I know road team, you've had it like with Tokyo had to have 8 games on the road a couple of years back for the Rugby World Cup, so okay in a, from a one-off instance, but it surely doesn't seem fair to ask them to do this season after season.
No, I don't think those clubs would go for it. I don't think that the players would go for it. I don't think the fans would go for it. And it's, you know, it is really a giant middle finger to the entire, basically everywhere north of Tokyo. If you're going to try to do that. And I think that from what's been reported, the northern clubs are still not on board. That you shouldn't take that to mean that everyone else is. But they absolutely have the most to lose. So, I just don't know. It's going to be really iffy. I mean, it's a really tight needle to thread from the J-League's perspective.
All right, well, yeah, something to watch, but something that I think, the three of us just find a bit perplexing that it's even been considered, in a serious manner. We're considering the climate problems that the league would certainly face, and I mean, you know, there's weather everywhere in the world, but I mean, yeah, there are lots of areas in the north of Japan that have snow for a almost a quarter of the year, and it's very difficult logistically, and obviously dangerous for the supporters, not only the players, to get around in conditions like those. So obviously, I guess we'll be watching this space, and I guess the ACL is a test run for how Japanese clubs will fare in a calendar like that, albeit obviously on a kind of a streamlined basis. All right, Dan, well I think we've held you for long enough. You've done a stellar job to bring us up to date on some of those changes, and some of them very, very positive, and I think a lot of us are looking forward to, but obviously others a work in progress. And you've obviously still been busy over the break, and more players moving to Scotland. I tell you what, mate, it's a surprise you haven't picked up a Scottish accent, even by osmosis, the number of Scottish media outlets I'm sure you've spoken to over the course of the last 18 months.
I'll tell you, I wouldn't dare try. I feel like I'd be burned at the stake if I tried, if I went. I can do many things. Accents are not one of them, so I will leave those to the experts. But it's amazing that in this last year we've gone from one Japanese player at Celtic to 4 to, I guess we'll be at 5 once Itaguchi leaves, as we expect, and goes to wherever he's going to, possibly Gamba. So now I think that it's sort of amazing that Celtic have made it into Japanese silly season lore. Now you have these rumors of Thiago Santana and Yuito Suzuki going, this Shimizu fire sale that a couple accounts have tried to cook up. But it's pretty wild.
You able to shed any light on those rumors, Dan? Is there any substance to them, do you think?
No, no. I mean, I think... No.
Fair enough.
No. I mean, you know what? I mean, I say that Yuito Suzuki, I mean, maybe there is a timeline in which that makes sense. There is a Doctor Strange multiverse in which, you can see Celtic taking a flyer on a young player and developing him. But then again, I mean, he did spend the second half of last season injured. I don't see him as a ready from day one player like Hatate was when he showed up, and I didn't even expect Hatate to adjust that quickly to Scotland, so he exceeded my expectations. And you know, Celtic aren't the sort of club who are gonna buy a player and then loan him out like that. That's just sort of not really what they do. Like, I feel like if Ange is going for a Japanese player, he wants them to play for him. So I don't know. I can create these conditions under which it makes sense, but I don't see it happening. Maybe in the summer if he has a really good start to the season. But he's certainly got potential. I think he'll be looking for a step up. I don't think he wants to spend the entire year in the J2.
All right. Once again, thanks so much for joining us, Dan. And we hope you feel better soon, and look forward to catching up with you again in the weeks ahead.
Absolutely. Have a good one.
Welcome back, and thanks again to Dan. A stellar effort there to battle through when he's obviously not feeling 100%, but we really appreciate him joining us. All right, Sam, so we mentioned at the intro that this is our first episode since Japan bowed out of the World Cup about a month ago. So I guess the wounds might still be a little bit too fresh, but I thought we might have a quick look back on events in Qatar for the Samurai Blue as Hajime Murayasu re-signed for a further 4 years as a Samurai Blue boss after taking Japan into the last 16 before their loss to eventual semi-finalist Croatia on penalty. So, I mean, as we look back, Sam, I mean, the wins over Germany and Spain that took them into the knockout stage, I mean, they'll go down in history. They'll be in highlights packages on Japanese TV for years and years to come. And, I mean, they were stunning results. There's no question about that. But, it's a redundant question, as we know that he's carrying on. But should the JFA have taken note of the fact that their opponents should have been out of sight at halftime in both of those games, and that Japan were woeful in the second group stage game against Costa Rica, and said, OK, well done, mate, but it's time for someone else to have a go?
Well, I think so. I think you get blinded by those results. And they were great results. We have to accept that. They were two of the best results Japan has ever got. So, yeah, fantastic for that. But at the end of the day, it meant nothing because Japan went out in the last 16, as they have done on a number of occasions. And there's no point beating Spain and Germany if you're not going to then take advantage of that. And Japan really didn't. They were set up in a position to win that game against Croatia. I don't think Croatia were that good. Japan were on top in the first half and then just sat back and allowed Croatia into it. And the kind of penalties summed up the lack of conviction that the Japan team had. So I wouldn't have been keeping him on. I understand why, of course, with the results. But then even if he was staying on, I'd give him 2 years. I think he has to prove himself that he's able to put in a more proactive team, a team that isn't going out to beat teams. Because in the Asian Cup, the Japan are going to be favourites for most of those games. They can't get into that situation where they're playing like they did against Spain and Germany, of sitting back, hoping to hit them on the counter-attack. They have to look to take games to opposition. So I think he maybe has these 2 years to prove that they are able to do that and to be able to play your best players a little bit more. But yeah, I'm still not delighted by it, but maybe he's earned an opportunity, but I have to see a lot more from him in these next 2 years.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, the group stage games in the Asian Cup could look very much like the Costa Rica game, right, where Japan are basically given the ball and invited on by the opponent, who then looks to hit them on the counter, as obviously Japan did so effectively to Germany, especially with Asano's goal. Exhibit A for Japan stunning Germany in the group stage opener. But, yeah, I mean, regular listeners to the podcast, and, you know, there might be some people out there who are big Murayasu stans who are, you know, really happy about this news. I mean, as you said, Sam, I don't think realistically the JFA were ever going to make a change, as much as so many of us would have liked to have seen it, because simply put, while he didn't get them through to the quarterfinals, beating those two huge European powerhouses in many people's eyes is enough. And the performances, when you look back in the cold light of day, weren't vintage Japan performances, but they were able to take advantage of the fact that those two nations weren't able to kill them off in the first half of those games. And yeah, to be fair, they stung them, and they ended up scoring the goals, and you know, fair play to them, they won those games on their merit. But I think your point's very well made that, maybe he should have been extended just through to the Asian Cup, and then, Yeah, because that obviously Japan could very much fall flat on their face, as you say, if they're expected to take the initiative in games. Well, yeah, we haven't really seen Japan do that too many times successfully under Moriyasu. And I hate to even bring up the topic, but are we set for another 4 years of Kaoru Mitoma as an impact sub for Japan?
Honestly, if he doesn't start every game that he's available for, then I think he should be sacked immediately. I mean, just watch him in the Premier League. He's now one of the best wingers in the league. He's taken a couple of games to get going under De Zerbi at Brighton. He is absolutely magnificent. I know you might not have completely enjoyed watching him at the weekend against Liverpool, but it just boggles the mind to see that player playing week in, week out for a very good Premier League team and playing as well as he is. And he was relegated to the bench for the entirety of the World Cup. And then when he came on, he played at left back. I mean, how can any sane manager be making those decisions? So he absolutely has to be finding a way to play Mitoma at left wing for Japan. I know there is a massive issue at left back because Nagatomo, you imagine, is not going to continue and he shouldn't be anyway. The other options, Nakayama and Ito, are centre backs that are being asked to push across. So there isn't a great option there. So I can see why he ends up with Mitoma, but really it's just hamstringing him and it's hamstringing the team. So yeah, has to play Mitoma and in general has to play his best players from the start, because so often he was looking to that second half and they'll play 45 minutes with their better players. So yeah, it needs to be more proactive from the start, and Mitoma starting is an absolute must.
Yeah, tell you what, poor old Trent, he's still untwisting his blood, I think, from the weekend. Yeah, it's quite a performance that Mitoma put on against Liverpool. Obviously, Solly March stole the headlines with his two goals, but Kaoru was a very much a menace down the Liverpool right. He's really taken to life under Zerbi, hasn't he? Mitoma looks absolutely fantastic. And we can do is hope that Moriyasu finally sees the light. I tell you what, we were definitely getting desensitized to Moriyasu Japan, Sam, by the end of the World Cup, because I don't think we even kicked up a stink that he didn't start against Croatia. We just assumed that he wasn't going to, and it didn't happen. So we didn't even bring it up, I don't think, in our podcast immediately after the loss on penalties to Croatia. But surely down the line, he's just got to realize that he's got to play his best players. I mean, he's kind of almost playing with house money now, isn't he, Moriyasu, through up until the Asian Cup. So he's got to he's got to get his best players in, as you say, and there's no question that Mitoma is his best player in attacking areas. And hopefully he will be unleashed on a regular basis. So, overall then, as you look back, Sam, a month ago, they were heady days for Japan. The performances themselves, have you had any time to reflect on them? And, I mean, it is a results business, and we were buzzing over the fact that they did beat Germany and Spain, in that order. But, I don't know, as you look back now, is there, they actually did all right, didn't they, against Croatia over the course of the game? It was unfortunate the way they went out on penalties so meekly. But, any kind of, bigger picture reflections on the World Cup a month out?
Well, I still just think it was a missed opportunity because, I thought first half against Croatia, they were good. They were a bit more front-footed. They put Croatia under a lot of pressure, and they should have continued that in the second half because it wasn't a great Croatia team. It was an aging Croatia team. Yeah, and I know they got past Brazil on penalties in the next round. But even so, on that day, I don't think Croatia were up to a great deal. They scored a very good goal through Perisic, but not one that they created through any great quality. It was a hopeful ball in and a very good goal from Perisic. But even after that, they didn't really offer a great deal at all. I thought they were there for the taking, but Japan were too negative. It was kind of like rabbit in the headlights where, we've got this real good opportunity, but we're not brave enough to go and take it. And I think that was the restriction from the manager more so than the players, because we have seen from those players, Mitoma, Ito, Kubo, Doan, whoever it might be, they've got players that will go on and take the initiative. And they did so when backs were against the wall in those Germany and Spain games. So it just needs to be that switch, and they need to be more front-footed and play. Because they showed, even in that Germany game, at the start, they were on the front foot for the first 15 minutes. They caused quite a few problems with Ito and Maeda going forward. So they showed on a number of occasions just how, when they go for it against the better teams, they can cause issues. But too often, they just retreated into their shell at the key moments. So hopefully, I mean, that Moriyasu has looked at that and then can work on it. I'm trying to be as positive as possible because I don't believe this is going to happen. But hopefully, there were plenty of lessons to learn from that. Hopefully, Moriyasu takes that on board, and then we see, a more expansive Japan, a more front-footed Japan against the better teams. And he really has to sort out against the lower teams as well. I'm not saying like these World Cup qualifiers where they play against teams from Myanmar B or whoever they played in the last round of qualifiers and beat them easily, because that gives you a false sense of security. But when you're playing, let's say, Iraq or the UAE, who are going to be similar, as you said, to Costa Rica, they have to show that they are able to go out and beat these teams and be a little more comfortable, because in that last World Cup qualifier, it was just a load of 1-0s, turgid 1-0s or whatnot against China and Vietnam, which kind of carried on. So he really needs to figure out that way. Hopefully, he sees that the players are there and he's able to do that. But it's going to be an interesting year, even though there's not necessarily any major games coming up.
Yeah, indeed. We can just hope for a more entertaining team from Moriyasu going forward. They obviously hit some huge highs, as we said, in Qatar. But overall, I think as we reflect the performances, there are a lot of things that Japan could have done better over the course of the tournament. And whether he'll be taking any of the lessons from there on board, I guess we will wait and see, and we hope he'll be a little bit more expansive in his selections as well. All right, so we mentioned it off the top of the episode. Over the course of the next 4 weeks, we will be previewing all 18 J1 clubs ahead of the big kickoff on the 17th of February. And we'll let you in on a little secret right now, listeners. The first 4 clubs we will preview on next week's episode are from the Kansai region. So Gamba Osaka, Cerezo Osaka, Vissel Kobe and Kyoto Sanga will be under the microscope. And speaking of those clubs, a couple of them are involved in some of the big moves of the off-season. So as a teaser for our previews to come, Sam, we thought we would finish this episode with a look at some of the, the high-profile moves in and out of the league so far. And a number of high profile players have switched clubs inside Japan over this winter break. One of the major headlines from the off season is that for the second time in the past 3 years, the reigning J1 player of the year has departed the league before the next season starts. So following in the footsteps of 2020 MVP Michael Olunga, who of course left Kashiwa for Al Duhail in Qatar after his golden boot season in 2020. 2022 Player of the Year Tomoki Iwata has left champions Yokohama F. Marinos to join the Japanese Revolution at Scottish champions Celtic. Ange Postecoglou had already taken Daizen Maeda from F. Marinos, so not really, too much of a surprise that he went back to his former club to pluck Iwata over to Glasgow.
No, not really. I mean, he had such a good season last year, and he offers so much in so many different positions. Playing last season centre back and holding midfield, he can also filter out on the right hand side. He can play back three if he wants. So it made a lot of sense for Celtic to bring him in. It is obviously a major blow for F. Marinos, but I'm looking at their team now. I'm still thinking Ryotaro Sonodo, who's played very well when he got the chance last season, he can come in at the back in midfield. You've got the likes of Fujita and Yamane, who we saw bits of last season, more so with Fujita. So I don't think he's absolutely devastating for F. Marinos and in the way that it could be if you do lose the MVP, and it was like for Kashiwa when they lost Olunga. But obviously, a huge blow for the league and for Marinos. But I think it'll be a really good signing for Celtic. I think Iwata will prove himself to be a good acquisition there. But I think I don't think it's going to be as negative as maybe it first seems.
Now Dan mentioned the possibility of Yosuke Idoguchi leaving Celtic and coming back to Gamba. What do you know? I should have asked him on the spot, I suppose. But is that likely to happen, do you think? And if so, what would that mean to the Gamba central midfield?
Yeah, I think it's fairly likely. I mean, he's very well low down the pecking order now at Celtic, even more so now that Iwata's come in. He just really didn't get going. He had maybe an opportunity when he first got in, but then got injured in his first game, which was kind of the story of his moves to Europe. So I do see him rejoining the J-League. Gamba seems the most likely destination. They need someone else in midfield, as Mitsuki Saito has left. So they've still got Darwan, still got Yamamoto. But yeah, Idaguchi should fit back into there. I know they're after an Israeli midfielder as well, which kind of has stalled in the last few weeks. But yeah, at the moment, they've got a few numbers in there, but maybe a little light on quality. So if you can get the Idaguchi of old back in there, I think that would be huge for them. And I do see that as quite likely to happen.
All right. So I did have a couple of other Gamba moves written down. Gen Shoji leaving to go back to Kashima, and Kosetani coming back to Gamba after his lengthy spell on loan at Shonan. But I think we'll save the discussion on those moves to next week, Sam. As I said, we'll be talking about the Kansai clubs in next week's episode. So, plenty of Gamba chatter to come next week, no question. But, speaking of former J1 Players of the Year, another has left F Marinos in the off-season. A 2019 winner, Terohito Nakagawa, has made the short move to FC Tokyo. Well, across Kanagawa, a four-time J1 champion Shogo Taniguchi obviously had a terrific time over in Qatar for the World Cup. He has left Kawasaki and will now face off against the previously mentioned Olunga in the Qatar Stars League after joining Al Rayyan. So, Iwata and Nakagawa both out for the champions F Marinos. And, I'm sure to Neil Debnam's surprise and frustration, Kawasaki have lost another central defender, Sam. And as we record on Monday the 16th, haven't replaced him.
No, they brought in Takuma Ominami before he left as a sort of cover option. He can play centre-back. He was kind of playing more right-back for Kashima last season. But, I mean, it's not the level that Taniguchi is. It's such a big hole to fill. And we know that Kawasaki are not really wanting to dip into the transfer market to buy defenders. So I think this is a major blow for them. I just think he left. I know they like to facilitate moves for players, but to allow your captain to go on a free to Qatar after just playing the number of games at the World Cup baffles me completely, but I suppose that's how it is in Japan. But this is just a huge loss, just not only just for his ability on the field, but to lose that leadership, to lose that fan favourite, I think it's a huge blow for Kawasaki. And I mean, they're showing no signs of making any sort of replacement, but they really need to in the next month. Not only in those positions, they need to get a little bit more depth in their squad. As we saw, I think that was a huge factor in the way that Yokohama won last season. Kawasaki need to have that, especially in defence, and losing Taniguchi absolutely does not help that cause.
Yes, indeed. So, F Marinos have lost two big names, and Kawasaki have lost, one of their biggest, if not their biggest, in their club captain over this winter. And another team that is, never really far from the headlines is Urawa Reds, Sam. And to many people's surprise, they have loaned their Danish striker, Kasper Juncker, to Nagoya. Obviously, Grampus very goal-starved in 2022, no question about that. And Juncker could be the ideal man to fix that issue. But, a big surprise. Well, for me, I know Juncker had his problems under Ricardo Rodriguez, but with Rodriguez shown the door, I was expecting him to maybe enjoy a bit of a fresh start at Reds. But instead, he's headed over to the Toyota Stadium.
Yeah, this was a real surprise for me. When I saw that Scorcher had come in and decided immediately that he didn't need Kasper Juncker, it was a real surprise. I mean, the amount of goals he scored at Bodo Glimt before coming to Urawa, and then when you saw him play, I mean, he's got such quality as a striker that you don't normally see necessarily in strikers in the J-League. So it is a real surprise that he's been allowed to go, especially on loan. It's going to be really interesting to see what last season was all about, because he didn't get much game time. Urawa and Rodriguez were constantly saying that he was injured. He was denying this on Twitter and saying that he wasn't, he was ready to go. So there were definitely some issues off the field. Hopefully for him, he can just concentrate on his football at Nagoya. I think a lot of clubs are going to have to be very worried about a partnership between him and Mateus if Hasegawa allows them to flourish. I think that could be a really interesting one. But it's been an odd season for Reds off the field. I mean, it's not confirmed yet, but it looks like Iwanami is going to go to Qatar. There is talk of Matsuo leaving for Belgium. Juncker already gone. So there's a lot of things out there and not a great deal has come in yet. I know there are these rumours about Georgios Giakoumakis coming in from Celtic. I'm still not 100% sold on them as much as they do get reported. But yeah, without him in, I think that, yeah, there are a few issues in that Reds team.
Yeah, definitely. As I said, they're never far from the headlines. And yeah, definitely a team that will be... yeah, I'm looking forward to previewing them in the weeks to come to take a bit of a status check at Saitama Stadium under new stewardship yet again with another fresh start on the horizon. All right then, so there's also been some big moves in and out at Kashima. As I mentioned, again, Shoji is back from Gamba Osaka, and indeed they're getting the band back together at centre back with Naomichi Wada back from France. His stint at Nîmes has come to an end, but on the flip side, Kentor Misao has headed over to Santa Clara in Portugal, much to Sean Carroll's dismay, I'm sure, but Sean's probably already planned his trip over to see Kento at some stage this season. So certainly a familiar name that will be missing from the team sheet at Antlers, and that will, I guess, take some getting used to. But so many moves in and out of the league, and indeed from club to club over the course of the winter, and we'll preview as many of them as we as we see relevant in the next 4 weeks. We're bound to miss a few, as I did with Takuma Nishimura last season, Sam. That's certainly one that's going to stay with me for a while, I think. Almost won the player of the year, and I didn't even give him a mention, but just for our first episode to reconnect, this was enjoyable. Obviously great to catch up with Dan, and as I said, we appreciate him battling through against the odds, but great to catch up with you, mate, and I guess the real work begins next week.
Yeah, absolutely. The road to the J-Pred 2023 begins next week. I haven't yet celebrated my victory from last year, but I will do that now, although J1 was my worst league, so I don't know what that says. But yeah, I'm looking forward to trying to formulate my plan for this year, because at the moment I'm sitting in it, I have no idea who's winning the league, who's getting relegated, and that is just the joy of the J-League. You can start any season and you have no idea what's going to happen. So I look forward to getting your thoughts and all our guests' thoughts over the next few weeks.
Indeed. All right. So, once again, we're kicking off our previews with the Kansai clubs in next week's episode. So, patrons, stand by your inboxes. There will be a call for questions on those four clubs coming very, very soon. Before we finish, we'd like to welcome in new patrons, Mark and Tom. Thank you very much, guys, for jumping on board. Perfect timing, I think, with the new season just about to get rolling. And, to all of our patrons, obviously, we always thank them all for their continued support. So, that's it for our first episode of 2023. Sam and I would like to thank Dan Orlowitz for his time on this episode. Again, to all of our patrons for their support. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/jtalkpod. All right, we'll be back to kick off our previews next week. Speak to you then. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yes.